Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson here, talking about one of my favorite subjects today. How you doing, Ryan?
I'm doing great. Yeah, and we're talking about oil and gas. And by the way, I'm going to make a quote. The world has a 120-year petroleum-based infrastructure. The current infrastructure is dependent on petroleum. Petroleum is used in roads, car, wheels, tennis rackets, lipstick, refrigerators, antihistamines, plastic items, cell phone cases, artificial heart valves, clothing, soap, hand lotion, garbage bags, and fishing boats. End quote. Billy Bob Thornton, Landman.
That's right.
If you haven't seen the show, it's really good. But he's right. Think about it. Every single thing we do every day relies on oil and gas. Every day. You can't escape it. Even if you're riding your bike to work.
Yep.
Or if you're...
The tires. The handlebars. Right. I mean, everything.
Everything.
It touches everything.
Everything.
And this is something that we did in our webinar of our most recent oil and gas deal, is we shed light on this. You know, after trillions of dollars of investment, the world is still 87% fossil fuels dependent. And by 2050, the estimate that we'll be down to 50. But there are petrochemicals in the microphones that we're speaking into right now, oil and gas. I mean, everything is made of hydrocarbons, specifically ethylene. You know, fun fact, I was at the Hart Energy Superdug conference earlier in the spring in Fort Worth, and I didn't know this. When Trump kicked off the tariff war with the world back in the spring, the only item that China did not put a retaliatory tariff on was ethylene. It is the feedstock of plastics. That was the only thing that they left tariffs untouched from the United States. So anyway, point is, unfortunately, it's not going anywhere. It powers the jets. It makes your plastics and your rubbers and everything that we use in modern day life. And how do we invest in it? There are a lot of different ways. Today, we have Tim Powell, who is has become a good friend. He came to us through our connection with Mark Fleming, our oil and gas consultant. Tim is the president of Minerals and Royalties Authority. He is a podcaster, a connector in space, and one of the really loudest voices and advocates in the oil and gas investment space, really knows everyone in the industry, knows how this stuff works. We just had a wonderful conversation.
Well, with that, let's get to the show.
Let's get to the show. Learn about it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Tim, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Tate, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, we've been really excited to get an expert like yourself on. I have been investing in oil and gas for a long time. In fact, we have an oil and gas fund open right now with Turbine Capital. We have moved very decisively in that direction over the last few years, particularly because it balances real estate very nicely and because of the tax benefits. I invest heavily in oil and gas because you're able to take very strong write-offs against your W-2 income, which is contrary to a lot of real estate where those losses can only be used against passive income. Oil and gas has extremely accretive benefits against active W-2 income. This is one of the ways that I pay very little legally in federal taxes. So in any case, we want to get into everything today, all things oil and gas investing, minerals, royalties, non-op. So in any case, Tim, before we do, let's get into your background. How'd you get into the energy space? Who are you? Where'd you come from?
Yeah, so I'll go back about 12, 13 years. That's what's relevant to this conversation, when my journey started with minerals. So I like to call it the birth of the institutional era of minerals. So this is 2013-ish. As a backdrop, the unconventional shale revolution starts around 2008. This is what really kicked off all this.
And what is that, just for the background?
Yeah, so think of, for everyone out there who's not an oil and gas, think of Carvel cake or any cake you get at a birthday party, and you have, you know, the vanilla ice cream and then like that fudgy crunch layer in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then the chocolate ice cream in the bottom. And everyone loves that little crunchy, you know, fudge layer in the middle, which is thinner. So imagine if that's where what's called the source rock, that's where the oil and gas is that fudge crunch layer in the middle. Traditionally, you would put the straw vertically straight down and you would just suck a little bit out as you vertically pass through it. And then over time, that oil would slowly kind of disperse itself into the vanilla ice cream, the chocolate ice cream. Well, what unconventional drilling and shale revolution unlocked was we could put that straw vertically down and bend it and suck up all the fudge like right out of the gate. And that's where all the juice is, right? So this significantly changed the game because technologically, you know, geologists thought that you can't do that. The rock isn't porous enough. It's too thin, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's a variety of reasons. Never underestimate, you know, human ingenuity and technology innovation. So the oil and gas industry cracks the code on this and it unlocks a tremendous amount of resources. It's really changed the energy security of the United States.
Right.
You know, in an incredible fashion over the last two decades. So that in 2007, 2008, that's when that technology really became commercial. And what followed in the next 3 to 4 years was this massive land grab for operators like Chevron and, you know, Exxon, just to use some names that people will know, start building these positions, right? To go out, lease, you know, set up their positions that they're ultimately going to drill wells on in years to come. So, you know, 3-4 years into that picture, groups start aggregating mineral rights under these positions because they, you know, for anyone who kind of understands finance, if you have a front-loaded yield profile in an investment, you can capture a lot of that income earlier on. And so an oil and gas unconventional shale well produces 60%, give or take, of the revenue in the 30-year life of a cash flow stream in 18 months. So think about it. It's tremendous. So if that back end tail of the next, you know, 28 years is going to clip coupons for you and give you cash, but at a much lower, modest level, if you can capture a lot of that up front, you can then go take that cash and reinvest it and do it again and capture 60%, compound it, do it again. And you can do it at scale, which never existed before. Because if you were going to buy minerals, typically back in the day, it would be under conventional operations. And one, you weren't able to capture that much yield initially because of the decline curve nature of a vertical well is much flatter.
Right.
And then second is just lower volumes. So just the scale of opportunity wasn't there for institutions like private equity, like insurance, pensions, publics to play in the mineral space. It was a family office game that if you knew about it, it was the best thing in town. But it was like, you know, 100,000 here, a million here. You inherited them in your estate and they were incredibly valuable. But there wasn't really anything to get, you know, private equity excited to deploy hundreds of millions of dollars and make 20%+ type returns, right?
Right.
The shale revolution changes that. And so private equity starts to back teams to go and aggregate these minerals, both producing and undeveloped in these shale formations. And then the first public gets formed, focused exclusively on minerals, called Viper Energy Partners out of the Permian Basin. They spun out of Diamondback, which is a large operator. This is when my journey started. So I was working for an investor relations platform at the time called Energy Council. They're owned by Blackstone Group in New York. I ran the Americas for them as a British-based company. And my job was just meet with CFOs and CEOs of oil and gas companies, credit funds, lenders in the space, and then anyone issuing equity. And I would just meet with everyone and figure out what the appetite was in the capital markets, where's money going? And lo and behold, this minerals thing kept coming up. And then the public company gets formed, Viper. A Canadian sister called Prairie Sky Royalty gets spun out of Encana, same year, 2014. And so I'm like, oh, what is this? Like, let me dig into this a little further. This is interesting. And this is, by the way, at a time where ESG is at its peak and oil and gas is the devil and,
right,
you know, the planet is being ruined and this is awful. And also in 2014, oil went from 110 to 30. It's known as the Thanksgiving Day surprise. There's a lot of geopolitics going on in the Middle East. And so at that time, oil and gas was not super popular when you went to generalist investors and investors in general. So it was kind of like, you're getting ready to go into an investor meeting and you're like putting on a bulletproof vest just because you know you're going to get shot at, right? And now minerals on the flip side was like positive.
Right.
And it was excitement and capital wanted to come into it and there's deal flow and it was new and there was yield. And it was like, well, as much as I like getting sucker punched all day long, I kind of like positive uplifting conversation. So I'm going to gravitate towards this minerals thing. And it wasn't really a space, guys. It was like 5-6 companies that had funds and these two publics. So I went around and as my job at the time was just know everyone and be a connector and kind of like have a good idea of the landscape and then just plug and play and put people in touch with each other to help deal flow move and capital move. So I just kind of went around with them and said, hey, who backs you? What's your structure? What basins are you buying? How are you buying? What's your secret sauce? Just trying to understand how the ecosystem worked. And then the next year, 15 more teams popped up.
Right.
And then, Texas Teachers Pension Fund came in. Ontario Teachers Pension Fund came in. CPPIB came in. Some insurance companies came in. A couple more publics formed. So now it's like kind of becoming like a little mini, still not a sector, but it's like a little mini like thing, like a trend. Go to 2016, another 20, 30 companies pop up. And now it's starting to become an ecosystem. And then, some of these original teams start to have exits. Middle management makes a little bit of coin, figures out the game and says, I can do this. I'm going to spin out, hang my own shingle. So then you get kind of a more mushroom effect of the space growing and you have an ecosystem of small fish, medium fish, large fish, whale fish, all, aggregating deals and then getting acquired by each other, ultimately feeding up to the publics. And so along the way, I just kept meeting everyone. I was just fascinated by the space. It was fun. It was exciting. And, probably 2017, you just start to get the rep of like the guy who knows what everyone's doing. So if you got something going on in minerals or you want to enter minerals or you need to sell your minerals, call Tim Powell. He'll point in the right direction. And I always joke around whether that's true or not. The key is to get people to believe that because then it becomes true because you get enough referrals, right?
Right.
So the same story keeps continuing. 2018, 2019, 2020, right? The space continues to grow. It becomes more and more of a focus of my time. And being the connector of that, this like new cottage industry. And at this time, although I was very well plugged in the investment space, it was the energy buckets of institutions, right? It was the two guys at a hedge fund that ran the oil and gas investments. And it was, the private equity firms that were energy focused, and it was the energy credit sleeves at large institutional investors. It was not the LPs, right? It was not it was not you guys, Turbine Capital and your base. So I thought to myself in 2019, if I'm going to build this network of investors to help, service the requests that I'm getting, how do I do that? And content was the answer because at the time, if you tried to Google about oil and gas minerals, you wouldn't get anything. You would get the websites to the publicly traded companies, and there was only, four or five of them. And then you would get links to mineral exploration in Australia, like just completely off the map. But there was this huge cottage industry of privates that were doing things very, very differently from the publics, because the publics are retail capital that are aggregating all the portfolios. But there's so many ways to skin the cat and make money in this space. So I was like, hell, I like talking. I've been wanting to do a podcast, ironically, for a while. And I had all this proprietary knowledge and relationships that I just like by accident built because I went down a fork in the road with a whim. So I started that podcast in January of 2020 to educate investors on mineral rights. And COVID happens and, everyone was listening to content then. And it just kind of took off out of the gate. And I got outside of my reputation and industry, just more of a personal brand, which really extended my reach profoundly. And that was when I started my own firm about 5 years ago. I spun out, got my securities licenses. I call myself a merchant bank. I invest myself. I'll do advisory work to back into interest and assets and funds. And then I also just work as an advisor to bring capital into deals and funds and also broker assets. So my currency is relationships and intel and constantly keeping that fresh and constantly growing that. So, I'll be in Midland and I'll host a dinner for 50 people and I have three meetings and I'm going to the airport and I got two Zoom calls. I'm just constantly chatting with people, and all these folks have become really good friends. But that's just kind of what I do, right? And you get a feel for the pulse of what's going on. And I remember it distinctly. It was the end of 2020, and I probably had a call of 30 phone calls in a couple week period, different minerals guys, and non-op keeps coming up. Non-op. And Tim, we're going to raise a non-op fund. We're going to invest in AFEs.
Tim, I want to cut you off here.
So I like to think my unique ability is to simplify stuff.
Yeah.
When I know that I don't understand,
right,
to help other people understand. And the only way that I can sort of be relatable to this is, have you watched the show Landman?
Oh, yeah. Great show.
I mean, come on. Great show.
Season 2 just launched.
I know. My wife and I obsessively watch it, right? So if you haven't seen Landman, it's on Delta in the seat back. Season 1's on there. I watched a couple episodes, got addicted. And then like Landman, it's like, wow, you're like basically living in the Permian Basin and you're following along with this guy that is working for a big owner of a bunch of oil wells. And it's highly dramatic and amazing. So props to the show. But help me break this down, because I know we're going to talk about the different types of ways you can invest in oil and gas. But what we see in that show is, who's the guy? Who's the actor?
Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah, Billy Bob Thornton. And he's running around and he's like, you know, he's working on these wells, right? Like these oil suckers or whatever they're called. They're pumping
pump jacks.
Oil out of the ground. Am I investing in that? What is that? Can I buy one of those? Is Tate's Fund buying that? Or what is that?
So yes, you can invest into that. But you can invest. So that is what we'll call upstream operations, or an EMP company, exploration production company.
Okay.
And they're going to have equipment in the field, storage tanks and roads and trucks and pump jacks, and they'll get rigs out there to drill wells, and you have to have frac crews. There's all the elements that it takes to run an oil and gas operation, and you have, you know, lots of people in the field and all that stuff. So the dynamics of Landman, the show, is of an EMP company.
Okay. Can I just make a comparison? So that's like a property management company managing a self-storage facility for somebody, or it just happens that that management company also owns the facility as well, but that's the operating company that's like set up to like run your operation, right?
That's correct. And imagine, okay, so there's all types of management companies out there. Imagine there's a management company that goes and buys self-storage facilities and then fixes them up or expands them. So that's one business model, which would be called a PDP growth strategy in upstream. I'm going to go buy existing assets, apply new technology to them, and lift production.
That's what the Sun does, right? Like he goes out and he gets these, or maybe Billy Bob Thornton's doing that. He's going to each well and he's like getting it back online, producing more oil per day. Like that's a value add strategy.
It's like value add.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
And PDP stands for proven, developed, producing. So it's an asset that's already been drilled. It's already producing, and you're just going in there and you're buying existing production and potentially juicing it.
So then going back to your self-storage analogy, what if you had a company now that has an inventory of self-storage assets, and then they're going out and now building self-storage assets, and maybe they're going out and they're doing the land side of it and the construction side. And then once it's ready at that point, then they sell it to a bigger company who just wants more inventory. So there's an ecosystem to it, but in general, a lot of the companies, they're the ones drilling into the ground and extracting the oil and gas out of the ground. And I should have said this earlier, but just to, what we keep saying, minerals, what are minerals?
Thank you for saying this, because I wanted to back up and really set the groundwork for somebody that doesn't understand any of this stuff. What are minerals? Thank you.
Oil and gas, as we know it, are sitting in the ground in molecules. Just think of, trillions of little tiny particles in the ground stuck in rock. Those are minerals, and individuals have rights to those. So when they get drilled and produced out and then sold, and then they ultimately become gasoline at the Shell around the corner or any other products related to oil and gas, the revenue that is made off of selling that production becomes a royalty stream, hence the name minerals and royalties for the asset class. So what's unique about the United States is that it's the only country in the world where individuals privately own mineral rights. You have small areas of Canada where there's what they'll call fee ownership, meaning privates own it. But for the most part, the government owns all the minerals, as does the government in every other country. So
right.
There's oil and gas in other countries around the world. But what happens is Exxon comes in and says, hey, government of Colombia, I'd like to do an agreement with you to have the pleasure to drill and extract your minerals and sell it for revenue. And then we will share that revenue. But if some sort of communist regime comes in and says, you know what, we're kicking out, we're changing the rules, you don't have any real asset ownership. So it's just kind of how the game is played internationally. In the US, individuals own these rights. It's an incredible $1 trillion asset class that the United States have, private ownership in the US has, that no other country has.
And real quick, I think it's so interesting, and a lot of people might not know this. Let's say you own a 100-acre ranch in Wyoming. You might think that you own the subterranean mineral rights, but you actually don't. Surface real estate ownership is different than ownership of subterranean minerals. And this is this fragmented ownership across the entire US of who owns the minerals under, could be your land. And you had no idea that someone else, some faraway person, owns the mineral rights under your surface land. Can you just expound on that a little bit?
100%. I think your audience understands real estate. Minerals are underground, oil and gas real estate. That's what it is. It's a real asset. It's an estate. And so you have the surface estate and you have the mineral estate. Now, what's going back to what I was saying earlier, you know, minerals have been around since the inception of the oil and gas industry in the US. So imagine over hundreds of years, if you own minerals in your ranch or any land you own, and you put those in your estate, and then you have six kids and it gets cut up. Imagine that iteration happening over four, five, six generations. And then in the middle of that, there's going to be people who sell or give stuff to their attorney, or, you know, for whatever reason, there's horse trading that goes on. So there's tens of millions of individuals that own this stuff, and it continues to get fragmented. As much as the funds I mentioned that I know very well aggregate these things into portfolios that the public can buy them and institutions can buy them, you have a baby boomer generation passing away and retiring right now, passing it on to the next generation, that continues to fragment it. So this concept of putting Humpty Dumpty back together again is like this self-fulfilling reservoir of opportunity that will really continually be there. And then you have all these pockets. You have trusts. Trusts are roughly 10 to 12% of the whole minerals market. These things are, you know, a lot of these trusts are not liquid at all. And so until a trust is wound down for whatever reason from an estate planning standpoint, you have minerals in there. No one can really buy them. You have tribal nations. I just had someone on my podcast the other day who does a lot of work in the tribal nation space. They collect $1 billion of revenue a year in oil and gas royalties. So these things are all over the place. And it wasn't really until 2013-14, when I mentioned I got started in this space, that you started to get aggregation at scale of these things. And so if you look at oil and gas as a 100-plus year industry, and then you have this emerging asset class that is really only 10 years old, that is sitting on the back of one of the largest industries in the world that has, you know, some of the smartest minds, smartest technology. It is such an interesting opportunity. And absolutely, outside of Texas, Oklahoma, a lot of investors don't really know about it. And I spend a lot of time trying to educate folks on it because the return profile is tremendous. You know,
I'm going to ask another kind of elementary question here to make sure the audience is kind of keeping up. So why would someone want to buy or own minerals? How would you buy and own minerals? And what are the pros and cons?
Sure. So going back to what you're saying, Ryan, about, you know, Landman, the show, and am I buying the rig and going, you know, buying the team that's going out there and handling the operations? You're not. And we'll get into non-op in a second, Tate, which right, you guys are investing into.
Yes.
Minerals and non-op are, they're non-control passive investments. So there's tremendous benefits to that, especially if you're not an industry expert. You don't have to worry about equipment and people and field operations and HR and all that stuff. It's really a financial instrument. And so that's one of the really big benefits of it. And you, the more you acquire, it really takes the same amount of people and resources to manage this stuff. So it's very accretive with scale.
And it's essentially like owning, if I own the land and instead of selling it to Ryan to build a self-storage facility on, I leased it to him. I said, I'll give you a 100-year lease, but I'm going to maintain rights to it. And you have to pay me on a monthly basis for the utilization of my land. Is that kind of a generalization crossover of minerals?
That's the surface. So you will lease surface rights over certain terms. Now, if an operator wants to come in and drill minerals, they have to go into a lease on the mineral estate with the mineral owners.
Which is sort of the parallel that I was drawing, is comparing it to I own some real estate and I lease it to someone versus I own minerals and I'm getting royalties when somebody wants to drill, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, you can get royalties when they produce it, or you get a lease bonus, which is an upfront lump sum of cash. And typically an operator has a certain term. It's usually 5 years to drill a well in a certain unit. And if they drill a well in that unit, it's called holding it by production, HVP. And that enables that operator control, you know, retain operatorship into perpetuity as long as that well's producing. If they don't drill and produce it in that period of time, the lease expires. It goes back to being unleased with the mineral owner, and then they can get another lease bonus in the future. So there's an interesting dynamic of long-term ownership of minerals, and that even if it's not getting developed, you can continue to get revenue on lease bonuses over and over again. You know, what you want to avoid is you want to avoid someone leasing your minerals and then never drilling them, because ultimately they're more valuable when they get drilled. So there's incentives around time and opportunity costs that the industry has made standard to hopefully get operators to drill that stuff as much as possible. But going back to your question, why would you want to own it? So, I mean, it's a real asset that is going to be, you know, the highest in the kind of bankruptcy protection totem pole, right? If a company goes bankrupt and you own minerals under their operating footprint, you don't go bankrupt. You might have to wait longer for your minerals to get developed, but you own them into perpetuity, right? So if you're going through cycles, you know, large credit cycles, political, geopolitical cycles of COVID, you know, the holding staying power of minerals are really powerful. So that's one major benefit. Two, from it's a really good complement to real estate, because real estate's a highly levered asset class, very sensitive to interest rates. The returns for minerals are essentially full equity. If you get a portfolio of minerals and they have a large producing component to them, you can take modest leverage out to juice those returns a little bit. But for the most part, most managers in the space that have minerals portfolios do not add any leverage. So that's incredibly attractive in a high interest rate environment, where you can get into a minerals fund and you can be getting, you know, 15 to 20% yields on, you know, an asset class that, you know, risk adjusted would be similar to maybe an 8 or 9 cap in real estate.
Right.
Now, you would say, God, if it's risk adjusted the same and you're getting double the returns on a yearly basis with yield, well, why wouldn't you do minerals all day long? Because there's volatility. This is why the returns are higher. So 1 year you might be getting 2 or 3% as a drastic example. Another year you get 30. If you have, you know, the ability to hold for 5+ years, you know, minerals tend to have a pretty good track record of delivering those blended returns. So if you're looking for yield, if you're looking for real asset exposure, and then there's no operating costs. So it provides a hedge on inflation as well. And commodities in general provide a good hedge on inflation, but minerals are the most pure form of that. Because if an operator is spending money to drill a well and operate a well, you're not contributing to that cost at all. You're just getting a portion of the revenue when it's sold.
Right.
So it's truly mailbox money, kind of like an oil and gas annuity in certain respects. And that kind of, you know, people scratch their head around that as well. I guess the easiest analogy from like a financial and operational perspective in real estate is a triple net lease.
Right.
It probably performs and acts a lot like a mineral interest, but you know, all those things are really attractive. Now, here's the other thing. If you own minerals in a ranch in the Permian in West Texas, and you know, you'd love to get, you know, another 100 wells drilled on them, but it's just not happening. You can't go to the operator, knock on their door and be like, "Hey, you need to drill my minerals." Like, you have no control. So you're in the back seat of the car. So that is one of the risks, is you're passive and you can't influence the drilling and development activity of it. But like I said, the benefit of that is, you know, you're not participating in costs and you're able to manage these things with a very small, lean team. And then if you're non-industry, you don't have to worry about, you know, how much frac fluid do I need and
right,
what's the latest technology? You don't have to worry about all that. You get to benefit off of it for sure.
What about the tax benefits of mineral ownership? It's my understanding that there's no real tax benefit to owning minerals.
No, there is. There's a built-in kind of conveyor belt of tax benefit on a yearly basis as long as there's production, and that's called depletion allowance.
Okay, so you get depletion allowance passed through as a mineral owner. So it's basically the first 15% of income is tax-free for the depletion allowance.
That's correct. It's just like depreciation expense on equipment. If you own a piece of equipment and you're, you know, managing a real estate building, like, that equipment's going to go down in value over time. Same thing for a well, and 15% is a good rule of thumb.
Very good. So essentially, just to break this down for the audience, so if I bought $1 million worth of minerals and it gives me 10% cash flow in the year, I get $100,000, but I'm only taxed on $85,000.
That's correct.
There we go.
That's correct. And it's taxed as ordinary income, just if we're going to talk about that. That's how it's treated.
But we are not talking about non-op, which we're going to get into next, which, you know, if I take $1 million and I put it into minerals, it's not like I get to write that off. There's no, you know, you put that into a Spartan real estate deal or something like that, you're going to get a K-1 that shows a 30%, 40% loss year one. Of course, those are passive losses, but you're not going to get any, you know, depreciation losses off your minerals. It's just that the income is tax advantaged.
That's correct. And so I told my story of getting into, this is where you kind of cut me off to like pull it back a little bit. 2021, at this point, I'm 100% minerals. Now I'm having all these meetings with guys in the space, and non-op is coming up in conversations left and right.
And non-op for everyone is non-operated working interests.
It's really, you're a minority participant in the drilling operation for an oil and gas company. That's really what it is.
It's essentially like being an LP in a real estate deal, limited partner, right? You're coming in, you're providing capital, you're buying part of the working interest in the well while someone else is doing all the work.
Yeah. Again, it's passive, which is great. There's a lot of similarities between minerals and non, which is why I specialize in both, but they all have, they're both unique benefits, and we'll get into that. And one of the huge benefits is the tax efficiency of it. But, you know, simply put, an operator is drilling a $10 million well and you own 10% working interest, you will get an AFE, which is really an acronym for the bill of drilling and completing a well, of $1 million, 10% of $10 million. And you participate in that, and then you get your proportionate share of ongoing operational costs and revenue as it comes in. So, this is not, again, I talked about like the institutionalization of the mineral space in 2013. Non-op working interest has always existed, but there wasn't a cottage industry for it, and it didn't really form until 2018-19. And there's two reasons for that. Number one, you know, capital, you gotta love capital markets. Whenever there's inefficiencies, capitalism finds a way. ESG caused a huge exodus of capital in oil and gas. So a lot of stakeholders became, you know, sensitive for, you know, political reasons right around, you know, oil and gas and hydrocarbons and its effects on the planet. And it's up to everyone listening to have your own opinions on that. But oil and gas is a huge cornerstone of, you know, how the whole world runs, right? And it's needed, and GDP continues to grow, populations continue to grow. We have more and more energy intensive technologies, like everything on our phone, we're using ChatGPT and Gronk and all that. I mean, highly energy intensive. So it's the amount of energy consumed is not going down. It's only going up to the right. and, you know, wind and solar and all the other sources of energy need to be there, but not to replace oil and gas, just to supplement it, because our needs for energy continue to grow more and more. And so imagine you have a lot of endowments from colleges, specifically on the coast, that are, you know, more liberal student bases, right? That say, you know what, we're not doing traditional hydrocarbon investing anymore. They were writing $200-400 million allocations to different private equity funds in energy. Boom, sucked out of the space.
Right.
A lot of pensions, similar types of things. And then on the lending side, a lot of Canadian and European banks who were big lenders of the space exit for similar reasons. And the ones that stayed around just had tighter covenants from what they could lend to. And so you just create this huge void of debt and equity capital. And what started to fill that was non-op funds. Funds were being raised to then now participate in these minority positions, which previously were being funded by, you know, bank debt for the most part. And, you know, private equity coming in and creating teams to go and fund this stuff. So there was a capital need that created the non-op, the need for the non-op fund. The second is, and this parlays really well into the tax benefits and why it's such a attractive thing nowadays, is just the evolution of the shale revolution. I mentioned it started in 2007. You know, from 2007 to 2016, there was a lot of science experiments going on, right? There was,
right,
the technology was incredible, but these companies continued to need to hone in and get it better and better. And when you're drilling different geologic formations, they all behave differently. And so these operators are tremendous, but they're not getting it right at the first go around. So the economic results of certain wells would be, you know, pretty skewed, right? A pretty big variance. And then there's certain areas where, you know, a company, imagine if a company has 1,000 potential locations to drill, they're willing to risk a certain amount of capital on 10 wells, 20 wells, whatever it is, to like prove the form, you know, prove the area. And then they're going to go and drill it out. If you're an individual investor in one of those first 20 wells and the economic returns aren't great, you're not like, well, it's for the greater good, you know, they're doing a science experiment for their broad portfolio. You don't care. You're participating in that well. You care about that well. So what's referred to as single well economics, we're all over the map, kind of first phase of the unconventional shale revolution. When you get to 2017, 18, 19, and to current date, we're not in a lot of that science experiment area. You don't have companies drilling leases to just to hold the acreage so that the agreement doesn't expire and they have to go redo a lease bonus. And maybe it's not the best economic conditions to drill that well, but they're going to do it for inventory purposes. You don't have those dynamics at play. You have Exxon Mobil making a $40 billion acquisition, a $60 billion acquisition. You have, you know, Chevron and these monster companies with arguably the cheapest cost of capital on the planet, building these monster positions of millions of acres and just systematically developing it with proven technology. There's not exploration risk. This is, if you go now and you go to participate in a well that Exxon's drilling or someone akin to an Exxon, it's far more predictable than it ever was, just right, using engineering and offset data. So I would argue non-op companies that are investing in these are really more statisticians than anything. They're just looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of data points all around to hone in on what we think the volumes of the well will be and what the performance will be. And that has changed the game on non-op investing significantly, because it just lowers the chance that you don't know the outcome. Is the more you can hone in on the variance of an outcome, the, you know, the more you can tighten up your underwriting as an investor. So
yeah,
the capital void and that combines to create the phenomena of non-op funds. And with that has created this secondary market that's fairly established and liquid now, where companies say, hey, if this position is non-core to me and it's a non-op position in my portfolio, I'm gonna go ahead and sell it, because there are funds out there that want to buy it. And that didn't exist really pre-2021, 2022. So onto the tax benefit and what's attractive about that. The tax benefit is not new. This tax benefit has been around for 100 plus years. It's called intangible drilling costs, or IDCs is the acronym. And then you also have bonus depreciation on equipment. So general rule of thumb, if you're going to be drilling a $10 million well, 80% of that is going to be towards IDCs. So $8 million bucks, 20% of that or $2 million bucks.
And for anybody that doesn't know what an IDC is, it's going to be labor, survey work, fuel, frac fluid, things that you can't sell on the secondary market. Those are sunk costs, right? So intangibles.
Sunk costs in the drilling operation, right? Yep. And then you have the equipment component, right? The casing on the well and the storage and all that. And so there's roughly 20% of the dollars going into drilling and completing a well get allocated towards equipment. Now, let's go back 100 years ago. Energy security is important today. It's always important, right? This is the cost of living for your citizens. It used to be wildly risky to drill oil and gas wells. I don't know the exact statistics, but just for case in point, say you're going to drill 10 wells, maybe one or two of them you hit oil back in the day, 100 years ago, eight are dry holes. Well, what is Warren Buffett's rule on investing? You know, number one, don't lose money. Number two, see rule number one.
Right.
Really risky when you can either like hit it out of the park or just get zero revenue. But this is the whole boom and bust, you know, oil man, rags to riches type of persona you see in the movies. This came from way, way earlier, right? That is not the current era of oil and gas. It's very much sophisticated investors, mitigating risk, hedging, all that stuff.
Absolutely.
And just statistically building these portfolios of yield and cash flow. So this tax benefit was put in place by the government to incentivize investors to take on this enormous risk to provide cheaper energy for the American citizen. That was really the impetus of it. That tax code is still there. It hasn't changed, but the oil and gas industry has evolved quite a bit. And going back to my point of it's in manufacturing mode, it's the unconventional shale has a very different investment profile. You can combine all that, and then you give the ability for a non-op investor to go in and take. You know, typically when you look at the IDCs being 80%, and then the bonus depreciation being 20%, and then you pass on, you know, different types of costs for the team that's managing it and their operations and G&A and all that, call it roughly 90% of your investment you can take a loss on in your first year.
Right.
Tremendous tool. I mean, tremendous. Now, again, this isn't new, but now go back to the old model before the non-op funds, where if you wanted that tax benefit, you had to take on tremendous concentration risk. So let's just use a scenario a lot of people might be familiar with. You're at the country club, or maybe you're at the Mile High Club for United and not Mile High Club. Let's the Mile High Club.
I just went there.
Yeah. So you're in a high end lounge in the airport, right? And you're around, you know, well off people, and one of the guys is an oil and gas guy, right? And he goes, "Hey, I used to work for Shell, and there's this field in the Gulf Coast. I've coveted it my whole career. Now I'm retired, and I'm going to go acquire it, and I want to drill four wells, and I'm passing the hat around. I need $15 million. And if we hit everything that I think we're going to hit, it's 120% return. Well, what happens if the costs go up a little bit, right? What happens if there's a delay on completing it and getting access to the right services? What about if oil or gas goes up or down 20-30% when all that initial production is coming online? Your juicy returns can go to zero really quickly. So there's a tremendous amount of concentration risk when you're putting all your chips in one basket on three or four wells.
Yes.
Now, on the flip side, you have these non-op funds who are going to give you exposure to 50-100 plus wells. They're going to be cost averaging into the market over an investment period. They're going to be hedging. They're going to be, you know, professional teams underwriting hundreds of deals to get you the 10 that matter. I mean, now as an investor, you get access to that passively and you get the tax benefit in the right knob structures, which Turbine, you're invested in one of those where it passes through.
Yeah.
You're getting tremendous asset level returns of 15 to 20% internal rate of return net to you, plus the tax benefit.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Show me something else in the market that's that powerful. You know, a lot of tax tools mitigate tax, and the performance of the asset is so-so, right? Or the investment.
This is why we think it balances real estate so nicely. And, you know, I have an excerpt from the IRS pulled up here, and it's a long document, but you get down into the meat of it, and it says activities that are not passive activities. The following activities are not passive: a trade or business in which you materially participated for the tax year; 2, a working interest in an oil and gas well that you hold directly, and it does not matter whether you materially participated. It just matters if your liability was limited, and you know that's a whole nother rabbit hole. But in any case, the IRS allows you put $100,000 into a non-operated working interest fund, you're able to take an $85,000 deduction. Basically, if you made $400,000 this year, you can get your adjusted gross income down to $315,000 by investing $100K in these deals. Now, I will say that my pet peeve in this industry has been the smoke and mirrors, because a fund, an investment strategy that has that powerful of a tax benefit can be very, very easy to sell. Mm-hmm. And so these things, because they sell themselves, there's a lot of funds that have exorbitant fees, egregious splits, lots of smoke and mirrors on the returns and the projections, and you can't tell what the return is on the actual investment, what the projection is on the investment without the tax benefit. Like, they all assume that you're in the 37% tax bracket and you live in New Jersey, you're paying 52% taxes, and so you're going to get that huge tax benefit in year one, and then they roll that up into the IRR, which, you know, irritates me because I want, you know, transparency. So that's why we built our fund to be as transparent as humanly possible.
And I think, as a guy who, you know, you have all the connections, you have all the experience and knowledge and know-how, and know how to refer people to the right opportunities, I think, you know, for me, one of the hesitations has always been just what Tate just said, right? The smoke and mirrors, the fees, the, like, how do you do your due diligence on somebody to determine that this oil and gas opportunity is legitimate? Because, you know, I feel like, you know, some of the sort of positioning is, yeah, you invest in this, you get, you know, near 100% tax break, you know, so you would have paid $100,000 in taxes, and now you're not going to pay any money in taxes. So anything, kid, is just upside now, right? And maybe there's no plan to make any money, or maybe it's some kind of a fraud or something. I mean, how do you go about, you know, sort of vetting these opportunities and making sure they're legitimate?
Sure.
I mean, that's always been a big thing.
So you're right. You know, it's such a powerful tool. There are a lot of fraudsters out there and promoters. It sounds very weird to say, like, I know everyone in the space, but these are very niche asset classes. And I told you my story. I started by accident at the beginning, like ground zero. So I really have tremendous relationships. If I don't know someone, like, that's a weird thing. I'm not going to say I know everyone, but if someone's out raising third-party capital and, like, are never at the industry events,
right,
never talked to them in 15 years, like, that's a little strange, right? That's number one. So I would be like a source to just kind of vet reputation. And then second would just be, I can tell you what kind of reputation they have in the space. Do they screw people? Are they fair? Are they honest? Like, that's pretty easy to sniff out. You know, when someone's a dog, they're a dog. Like, it's not hard to... And authenticity, I think, is infectious and very easy to align with. So
absolutely.
That's I'm just trying to, like, get everything fair and give people access to these asset classes, which are phenomenal. Asset level returns of them, phenomenal. The tax benefits, phenomenal. Just, you get a little angst when you just don't know anything. And the key is just transparency and just showing them. If people get afraid to show you things and lift the skirt and all that, then that's typically the first red flag, right? It should be simple and transparent and not complicated to understand.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to conclude with, how do people learn more about this industry, and how can people get in touch with you to learn more about what you're doing? And Tate, I also want to put in a selfish plug for, how do we learn more about Tate's,
for sure,
oil and gas fund? Yeah.
Tim?
No, well, thank you for that. I have a podcast. It's called the Minerals and Royalties Podcast. If you Google it, you'll find it anywhere podcasts are. If you go to my LinkedIn, Tim Powell, that's P-A-W-U-L, I have kind of become the de facto newsletter of the space. So I'm posting content every day. It'll be press releases. It'll be deals people have done. It'll be repurposed content that I create. It's just, it's all minerals and non-op. And, you know, some personal stuff in between philanthropy and family and everything like that. But it's all minerals and non-op. So if you follow those two content mediums, you'll start to just kind of slowly get immersed and educated on it. And then if anyone's interested, just having a conversation, asking more personal questions about, you know, that they have or wherever they are in their journey, I'm always happy if people want to DM me on LinkedIn and reach out. I'm happy to help and just be a resource there. And also, you know, Tate's going to come on the podcast soon. So
that's right.
We're going to flip the table and have him come on. But yeah, just really appreciate the opportunity to come on, guys. As I mentioned, I'm just trying to be out there educating folks. And this is a really unique audience. And I'm excited to get to know a lot of people listening.
Thank you so much, Tim. Well, we certainly burn a lot of hydrocarbons in this job. So it's appropriate. And we'll link to all that in the show notes. And yeah, we worked really hard on this in 2025. We started putting this fund together earlier in the year. We've had a couple of oil and gas deals in the past. Those have gone very well. And so we have moved decisively into the space. And yeah, we put together a non-op fund. We're going to have diversification about 50 to 100 wells in there. We cap our interest at 10% in everyone in any one well. And we're open till December 5th. So if you have some you know, strong income that you need to shelter, come check it out. We got a great data room on the Turbine Cap website. So with that, Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. Very much appreciate your wisdom. We'll have to have you back on at some point to dig in further because I feel like we only scratched the surface here. No pun intended. Thank you again.
Yeah, no, I no pun intended. I hope the episode takes off. I like what you did there. I had to do it.
Ooh, right back at us.
I appreciate it. I really enjoyed it. And it's been a pleasure getting to know you, Tate. And I look forward to working with your team going forward.
We look forward to seeing you in February as well. We'll be at the NAEP conference in Houston, Texas. February, I forget the dates, but we'll link to that in the show notes as well. If anybody would like to buy a conference ticket and link up with us there, we'll be at a bunch of industry events in February down in Houston.
Yeah, February 18th to 20th. I'm actually partners with NAEP. I help run their Minerals and Non-Op Hub and moderate a bunch of their sessions there. And I have a discount code, so I can save you $75. You know, Tate, I'll send that to you. And if anyone's interested in going, and that'll, you know, save them on their register.
Perfect. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. I wish I had that. I booked my tickets a few weeks ago. So,
well, you know, I'll buy you a couple of drinks. We'll make up for it.
You got a deal. All right. Thank you, Tim. Great seeing you.
Thank you, Jeff.
See you on the next episode, everyone.